Freedom Gospel,
set free from despair, atheism. We're seeking to share the gospel with friends, colleagues, family, and we're seeking to equip ourselves a little bit and encourage ourselves, equip and encourage, in the beauty of the gospel and, in a sense, its superiority over the other offerings that we've had. We've thought about Islam, thought about secularism, thought about cults last week, and tonight we think about atheism. So the format's going to be slightly different. I will refer to this text that we're looking at, but yeah, it'll just be slightly different tonight. So that's what I hope to be able to do. So I hope at the end you're able to go, yes, Jesus is epic, and God does make sense of my world. And this is the gospel, and the following of Christ is far superior to the offering of atheism. And then hopefully have confidence as you go and talk to your friends and family, etc. I'm going to flag two books to begin with, and this one is called Making Sense of God. I just realized it doesn't have the cover, so that's of no use. That's not what it looks like. I'll take all my dust jackets off. It's called Making Sense of God by Tim Keller. And why do I flag these? Because you might want to explore some more. I'm not going to answer everything in 30 minutes. But these will be good. I would say this would be a good direction to go in if you want something that is a little bit challenging, but will give you some good answers. And this one here by Gavin Ortland, Why God Makes Sense in a World That Doesn't. He's recently written that. I think he'll write at a level that's engaging, but he's a thoughtful guy. So there's two books. Come talk to me afterwards if you think, oh yeah, what's more about that one? What are those books? And there you go. Now, two books. I'm going to read this one now in a minute. Okay. So what I'm going to do is it's going to be like a little bit like a testimony and a little bit like a sermon and a little bit like a bunch of arguments. It's kind of going to be a mashup of all of those things as to why I think the God of the Bible is believable. And I'm going to begin. I say the God of the Bible because I'm not talking about a generic God. I don't think that's the way to do it. Atheism, the opposite, would be theism. But we have to talk about the God who is. And there is only one God who is. It's not just God generically, it's the God of the Bible. And that's the God of the Bible that I think is. I'm going to begin. One reason, and these are not reasons that I became a Christian. They are reasons that have gathered up over the years. Some of them were instrumental. Some others I've just thought about them as time's gone on. And this first one, the reasons why, is that atheism is old. It's so old, right? This is a book by Hilary of, he was the bishop of Poitiers, which is a place in France, and he was born in 300 AD. And he's, at the beginning of this book on the Trinity, he's trying to find answers for his existence, and he's recounting now some of the offerings that have been given to him by people, suggestions for how he should think about the world, okay? And this is what he says. Some of these teachers, that's the people that he's approaching to find out what should I believe about the world, brought forward large households of dubious deities, and under the persuasion that there is a sexual activity in divine beings, narrated births and lineages from God to God. That's like the Greek myths, perhaps, or something like that. That's one offering. That's one explanation, could be. Others asserted that there were gods greater and less, of distinction proportionate to their power. That's a second offering. Some, now listen to this bit, denied the existence of any gods whatever, and confined their reverence to a nature which, in their opinion, owes its being to chance-led vibrations and collisions. Anyone heard that before? Right? Fascinating, hey? 300 AD, born, 330, same offerings. Some of them are on the table today. I'm not going to read them all out, but the important thing to note is not new. So when somebody says to you something silly like, oh yeah, back then everybody believed in gods and stuff, and people couldn't conceive of a world without a god, nonsense! Hilary of Poitiers. Right there's a man. Not only that, we could go back further to 500 BC, before the pre-Socratic, they call the pre-Socratic philosophers, which means that they are the philosophers that were around before Plato and Socrates. And in 500 BC, there was a whole bunch of philosophers, and I can't remember if my philosophy teacher told me that they were many or most of them. They were materialistic naturalists. Materialistic means they only believed that matter existed. There was nothing non-material in existence, no mind or anything like that. And they were naturalists, which means they meant everything operated, all the things that happened in the world happened according to mechanical laws. That's what they believed about the world. This is 500 years BC, and apparently it's where we have the word atom from. Atom, the A being used same like atheism, like not theism, and atom meaning not cuttable. That they thought there was something down there that you couldn't divide any further, some basic element in the world. Why does that matter? I think that's relevant because that feels like the same pursuit today of so many people. And that hasn't changed. Why does that help? Is because shouldn't alarm us if people bring up that particular argument that, you know, lots of people believed in gods and myths and all sorts of stuff like that back then. It's just simply not true. A better question would be, and here we turn the tables, why didn't it catch on? That's a good question. Those philosophers were a big deal, right? We've got their writings. They survived. Why didn't it catch on? And I would say because that philosophy, materialistic naturalism or atheism, which I think go together, is wholly inadequate to explain life, the world, and the human condition. And people know it and they want more. And how could something like that fail at such a critical juncture? And I'm going to make that point again tonight. People still today want something more than that. The whole wellness movement would be an example of people who don't just want a body that's right, they want something else that's right. They don't just want health food, they want a healthy soul. They may not say it like that, but they do. And apparently the whole crystal movement is like taken off. It's like a big thing. Crystals, charged with energy. Last thing I'll say on this first point is that materialistic naturalism, or atheism, if you're into that, is not science. So just let's not equate those two with science. Science is God's discipline. So let's just like get the science thing out. Science is God's. Christians can and should be scientists. That's awesome. That they'd be watchers and discoverers of God's treasures in God's world. That's what I would say a scientist is. The scientist just needs to remember that what his task is, that's what his task is, and what its limits are. I think that that worldview is a belief, rather, materialistic naturalism, is a belief that governs how one does science. That's really what it is. It's not proven by science. A world without a God is not proven by science. That mechanical world where things are all just made up of atoms, that's a faith and a philosophy. I'm not going to linger there. That's what I'm going to say. So, moving on into why I believe there's a God. Romans 1. So that passage that we just read, just two important things to pick up on. And the first one is here that God says, right? So this is what God says. God says that the creation is sufficient for understanding and belief and knowing that there's a God. And look what he says at the end of verse 20. He says, it's clearly seen so that men are without excuse. It is sufficiently knowable that there is a God through the world that he's made. And I'm going to riff on this now and we're going to sort of almost really just unpack and think further about, okay, how does that work? But it's sufficient that men are without excuse. People will be held accountable at the end of the day in judgment for not believing God because he was clearly seen in creation. People should know and believe, and there is a sense in which they do know that there is a creator, and they'll be held account for it. Right. That's Romans 1. Let's think about the world. For me, the world was just simply too wonderful to not believe that there's a creator. And many of you will have seen similar things. You'll have heard different arguments, you know, the fine-tuning argument, like the way the world's so carefully balanced that one degree here or one degree there and everything would either like turn into flames or freeze or something like this. Everything just goes out of whack with like this tiny little tinkering with the planet. What about the wonder of math and the fact that we discover math? We don't create math. Apparently loads of mathematicians, I didn't know this, they think of mathematics as discovering things that are there, not as making something up. That's mental. What about the size of the universe? Everybody knows. Breathtakingly huge, isn't it? You watch that Louis Giglio's thing and you're just like awestruck by the magnitude of the universe that we're in. I can't and I won't just turn my back on that sense of God because someone says that I mustn't. I must do that, right? I'm not going to do that. What about the sound of music? What about ears and music? What about ears and music and hearts that can be moved by it? What about emotions? What about colors, sunsets, hills? What about the wonder of love and hope? What about all these relational people right here with all these crazy complex bodies that self-repair, and then all these minds that you're all listening and puzzling and thinking and feeling and weighing things? That's so deep. The world is too wonderful for me, and I just can't say there's no designer, no sustainer, and no architect behind it. To say, here's an alternative, that it is theoretically possible that there are infinite universes. This is a popular offer, alternative. There's infinite universes and we just happen to live on the one that works consistently all the time. Theoretically, it's right. Okay. It possibly happened. Okay. It just happens to work away and it just does all this wonder. I just think that sounds ridiculous. That just sounds like ridiculous special pleading. And here's the thing. Nobody lives like that. Who lives like that? Who lives on those odds? Who says to themselves, whatever even the odds are, infinite odds or something, right? Yeah, I'm gonna base my life on that. Nobody does that. You don't even do that when you go to the shops. Nobody lives like that. But I can believe in a heart that doesn't want God. He's there. But a heart that doesn't want God meddling in my life and telling me what to do because I want to be the master of my ship. And that's what the Bible, surprisingly, tells me would happen. The Bible tells me that's exactly what people would do. And so the Bible got there first and gave me the answer. And I go, oh, wow, that's deep. Okay, so what am I now? I'm going to third thing, meaning. So I think atheism leaves us without meaning. That's how I read it. I can't see how you can find meaning in atheism. And I need meaning that's deeper than simply a meaning I create. I remember talking to a bloke at Debenhams that I used to work with, my manager. He said, we just create meaning. I just thought, I don't see how. I need a meaning that's grounded, that taps into something solid and real, a meaning that's inherent and there. That I discover, not I create. Because if I create it, I know it's fake. Don't I? That's not meaning. And on an atheistic view of the world, everything that you do is meaningless. That's what it really is. And at the end of the day, everything will eventually wind down at some point. We all know that's like a science thing, apparently. Everything will wind down and there'll be nothing. There'll literally be nothing from the start and nothing at the end, and that'll be it. You raised a child, they raised a child, you gave your life for someone, and the universe doesn't care. And nobody really does, because it's all meaningless. If they cared, they just made it up, apparently, unless I've got this something wrong. Everything will eventually be completely forgotten and indeed utterly meaningless.
And I just, if apparently that's no joke. That's like a, that's the alternative. I just think, wow, that's, I don't know how you live like that. So again, we come back to an atheist explanation that can't, of the world, that that view, that can't explain or satisfy that deepest of realities and longings that I have. And not only that, one which it appears to me from empirical observation, everybody else wants, such that we'll say, okay, well, we'll make our worldview fit so that we now create a meaning. That just seems so radically flawed. And again, how could it miss there? How could it miss this? How could it be so wrong at such critical junctures? Number four, morality. I believe in right and wrong. Again, not just a right and wrong that I've imagined for myself, but one that is indeed right and wrong. And here's the point on this one. Everybody else does as well. I've not met a person that doesn't. And here's how, if you're saying to yourself, no, that's not true. I just love this. This is just like the best thing. I got you. All right? I love you, but I got you. Because if in your head you thought to yourself, nah, that's not me, you just started proving me right. Because every time you start arguing, you can't get away from oughts and rights and wrongs. Just the very act of reasoning and arguing in your mind, you're arguing for something positive or negative. So everybody does it, and everybody I think that's been in an argument would, by experience, show that they also actually believe it. And again, it's just not livable. I don't think it's livable to not have a standard, or to have a standard that you genuinely think is not fixed and stable, and one that you either ought to conform to or others ought to conform to. I won't say much more about this, but I can't see how morality exists in matter alone. Nobody charges the water for eroding the rocks and removing them from their home. If morality is not eternally rooted in an eternal and uncreated being, then it is not fixed. And if it's not fixed, then it's flexible. And I just can't believe the complex arguments that try to get around that. Now, materialistic naturalism, number five, is too implausible. At the beginning of Bill Bryson wrote this book, can't remember the name of it now, Short History of Everything or something like that. And the beginning of the book, he's talking about this thing called a singularity. And he's trying to explain what a singularity is. I can't remember the exact details, but it's roughly like this. It's this thing that you can't see, and it's a thing that exists in space, but there is no space. So it's a thing that is there, but it's not a thing. And it's not in a space. And you can't think of blackness or whiteness when you're thinking about this thing, because that would be to think of something, either blackness or whiteness. So you can't think of those things. But apparently it's a thing, and it's a singularity. And then out of that thing, with no apparent cause, I can't see how he explains it, everything just eventually spun out, and it kind of like progressively developed up here. And when I'd read that, I'd just been studying, that's the singularity, right? The beginning of the universe, apparently, according to Bill Bryson. I haven't studied all the options. This is just one of them. When I read that, I'd been studying the Christian doctrine of God at college. And I thought, wow, you are really asking me to believe something no less extraordinary and no less unknown to me than the essence of God that we've been trying to like think about, or the Trinity. I just thought, man, am I reading a science? Like, what am I reading here? You know? And are you for real supposed to get me to think that you've given like an explanation of the world that is not now asking me to step out in faith and believe something that is like really, really far out there? And I just think that that's just too implausible. That, and all, everything at the end of the day when it came to it just sounded to me like you're still trying to say all this came out of nothing, and I just don't get how that works. It seems too implausible. A couple of others that seem implausable within, you know, under this same heading. I don't know where individual responsibility comes from in a world of randomness. Are my actions just accidental outworkings of which I have no real control? And how many of my actions can I put down to chemical makeup Do I have a mind? What even indeed is my mind? If it's, is it immaterial? Is it material? What is consciousness? And the thing is, the Bible has an answer for this, and it just jams and gels with exactly what we experience and what we know. It says that there is an immaterial part of us. It's our soul. It thinks and feels and wills. And that makes sense. And that would be our mind. It includes our mind, which does our thinking and feeling and willing. It explains to me my experience, and it grounds it in God. What about a God, this other view, this singularity view? It seems implausible to me that the personal would come out of the non-personal. How did the non-personal and non-relational develop into the personal and relational? Did the river flow upstream? It just seems far more plausible that a personal and relational, moral and rational God made personal, relational, rational and moral beings in his image. Atheism asks me to believe too much. And there's more, but I won't, I think I'll stop there on those ones. So in the end, I think I'm going to say one more thing, and then I'm going to say something about the eyes of our heart. So this last one is, in the end, God seems more rational. And what do I mean by that? I think if rational, what do we mean by rational, if not the best explanation? The most rational thing needs to work on all the levels, not just one. It needs to speak well to morality, relationality, rationality, society, the objective world, the animal world, to history, to the mind and to the heart, and it needs to be consistent as it does so. And I just don't think atheism does that. Christianity gives me such a good explanation of the beauty and the brokenness of the world. It explains, just to pick up one of them, explains society so perfectly. Because we're made in God's image and still retain that original image in some form, we have a built-in sense of right and wrong. We're not totally corrupt, but we're not totally irrational. But because we've wandered from God, the image is distorted, and hence why we cannot get ourselves properly straight. We are immoral and irrational. We are. We're both of those things. We know it. We don't live up to our own standards. We don't follow our own logic. And again, the Bible says that this would be the case. And we see it everywhere. The Bible is more rational. It makes a better explanation of our experience, the world that we're in, the society around us, our own internal turmoil, our own sense of the greatness of humanity, but also the misery of humanity. Are we great? Are we not great? The Bible's just got such a good answer. Also, Christianity is consistently livable. That's an amazing thing. It's livable. Our forgiveness, where we forgive one another, rooted in the forgiveness that God offers us. We can argue on a basis because we believe in reason and also in right and wrong. We can fall in love. And we can say that's what it was. And it was something different than just matter and motion. We can fight for justice. And we can say, I'm not just creating meaning. It's not just our society doing it over against another side. It's not just because collectively at the moment we've all thought that this is what is the right thing to do. It was always wrong to child sacrifice. That was always wrong. And we can always fight for justice. And as grounded in God, I can genuinely discover purpose, and not a purpose that I'm making up, but a real purpose that is there for my life, that God has for me, that I can tap into something that is meaningful and will last forever. That sort of, you know, what's that echo? What we do in this life echoes into eternity? Yeah. That's right. I can live with real hope. I can look back with honesty and confidence at history and the past. Jesus explains my emotions. Beauty is real, and it tells a story. Beauty is not illusory. The beauty of your spouse, the beauty of the sunset, the beauty of the story. The world is electric with meaning and purpose. And that's not made up. According to the Bible, that's real. So Jesus speaks to my whole person and my whole existence. And he deals, and he's got an answer for our failings as well. He doesn't flatter me, but addresses my sins. He doesn't condemn me in them, but offers to lift me up. Restoration's not a myth, but it's a reality. All that, you know, all the longing, the stories of the world that we hear are all echoes of the best and most real story. All those threads of sacrificial love, redemption, heartache, final victory, joy. Christ is the substance. A position that tells me I'm meaningless and insignificant just doesn't quite get it. And a view that says that I'm the best and I'm the center doesn't get it either. Okay, so all of that, that's just one way to think about the world. I've just like fired out a bunch of different things. That's just like thinking about the world. The world is sufficient to condemn people. I'll read it again. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. Now I'm going to finish here. Here's the last thing. And you'll have to concentrate a little bit here for this. Often when discussions like this happen, I think that subconsciously we've made a distinction between our heads and our hearts. Or we've made a distinction between our thinking and our feeling. Or we've made a distinction, or we've totally taken off the table a kind of knowledge that we have that is not what we might call head knowledge, right? We've reasoned. I've looked outside of us and I've tried to make arguments, make a case for things, right? Part of the way that I've argued is I've tried to tap into that other component of us as we speak about beauty, love, those other components, right? Forgiveness. But what I think is taken off the table so often and is wrong is the eyes of the heart. We had it the other day in Ephesians. Paul prays for the Ephesians that the eyes of their heart would be enlightened. What is he talking about? He's not talking about what you can physically see with your senses. And this is the same thing as it was with Jesus when he walked the earth. You would not have been a believer necessarily just because you saw Jesus walking the earth. You would not be a believer if you saw Jesus crucified on the cross, buried in the tomb, and then angels knock you over, roll the stone away, and Jesus walk out of the tomb. Because that's what happened with soldiers, and the Pharisees were told that very story, and they didn't believe. They were given the best evidence ever. The soldiers came back and said, "This is what's happened." The Pharisees should have gone, "Wow," right? If the only way knowledge came to us was in our heads, as it were. But that's not how it works. We've got the eyes of our heart. We've got a soul. And that part of us has the ability to know things and see things that just thinking on that top level or making that distinction, trying to, I think it's a fake distinction that we make. I think we're always thinking with our hearts. That's Mark 7. But because so much of the world has done that in the way that they talk about whether there's a God, they've stacked the deck so that it's an unfair game, right? Because they've taken that knowledge out like it doesn't exist or like it's not even real, right? But the Bible says that part of you is real. And that is the part of you that does the knowing of who Christ is. Christ died. Here's just to see how you are doing this. Christ died for sins. That statement, for sins, that's a theological statement. That's not a statement that you can do empirical evidence on. You can't find that. As soon as you say Christ died for sins, you're saying something about me knows something that plain level, only head thinking alone and empirical observation can't tap into. And you do it all the time. I'll give you another example that's easier, maybe easier for you, that we do it all the time, that this part of us is a part of us and we have to include this in our conversation, we have to include this in our thinking and in our knowing, is if I say to you, what is comfort? What is comfort? What is it that to feel, what does it mean to be encouraged? What does that mean? And you try and explain it without talking about some immaterial emotional part of your life. What does it mean to have courage? What does it mean to have hope? What does it mean to have joy? What does it mean to have peace? What do any of those words that who is not going to say, those are the things that I want in my life? Right? How are you going to explain those things, what they are to me, without talking about your feelings? Or some part of you that is knowing and experiencing that thing that is purely in your head, as it were, right? Hopefully you've come along and seen this. That's critical. Because what happens is we don't believe in God just because the arguments stack up. We believe in God because the light of the knowledge of God has shone into our hearts. God has shone into our hearts to give us that sight and knowledge of Christ in his glory, who he is, what he's done, to see the magnitude. Jesus is not just a man walking around. That's that moment of, boosh, I've been teleported into something completely different here. I'm in the presence of Almighty God, who has died for my sins. I've got a sense of sin. I'm going to stand before this holy God, and Christ has died for my sins. There's a spiritual knowing that the world is just not going to know. You can we can say all of these things that I've said. The world just won't know that kind of knowing. But you know it when you know you're a sinner and you've seen the beauty of Christ. And here's the thing. If there was a God in the world, and I'll finish here, we can do it hypothetically. If there was a God in the world, it would make perfect sense that he would need to be a part of the explanation for how we know him. You tracking? I don't know. Just think about that statement a bit more or something. I'll say it again. If there was a God in the world, let's just do it hypothetically. I'm saying that it is the reality. But if there was, it makes perfect sense that he would need to be a part of the explanation for how we know him. If the God of the Bible did exist, he would need to reveal himself to us in that part of us. That's how it would have to work. So to try to have an explanation sufficient without reference to him and his work is to fail from the beginning. Again, that's what I was saying about the stacked deck. You can't win that game because you've taken the critical cards out of the deck. So if the world says to you, play it like this, play only with these cards, play only with thinking under my terms, make your case in that way, you can't, because that's not the world we live in. That's why it doesn't work. We don't live in that world, so that can't be an answer. But if we do live in the world with God, we need God to show himself to us. And that's exactly what he does through his Son. And he says to us, as I close with an offer, that you can know him. And anybody can know him. You can come to him if you feel that sense of conviction of your sins, feel that sense that you've lived your life apart from him. You can know that God, you can know God personally as a personal being, as a father and a friend, not an idea, because that's not what we've been talking about. And life is about knowing him. And If you want to know more, come talk to me afterwards and I'll explain how. But I'm going to end there.